Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Labor and Employment Law Practice Group, was recorded on Tuesday, February 20th, 2018, during a live teleform conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's teleform conference call as today we discuss the Janus Public Sector Union dues case. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President, General Counsel, and Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future and will likely be transcribed as well. We welcome today two guests, both return guests, I think, to Teleform. William Messenger. Bill Messenger is a staff attorney at the National Right to Work Legal Defense Foundation, Incorporated. And Ilya Shapiro is a senior fellow in constitutional studies at the Cato Institute, where he is editor-in-chief of the Cato Supreme Court Review. And he's also, I don't think you mind me saying, Ilya Shapiro, recently for the second time a father. So congratulations to Ilya Shapiro, and welcome back to both of you. We're going to get opening remarks from each of about 10 to 15 minutes. As always, we'll be looking to the audience for questions, so please be thinking of those for when we get to that portion of the program. With that, Bill Messenger, the floor is yours.
Thank you, and thank you all for listening in today. Of course, this teleform is about Janus v. Ask Me. And the issue in that case is whether it's unconstitutional under the First Amendment to compel public employees to pay so-called agency fees to union representatives to keep their jobs. This is an important issue because, among other reasons, there's roughly 5 million public employees who are subject to these fee requirements. Mr. Janus, the petitioner in this case, asserts that it's unconstitutional to compel him and other non-members to pay fees to a union to keep his job, and that it violates his rights to free speech, namely that the fees implicate his right to not be compelled to support speech in an association with which he disagrees. The union respondents in the state of Illinois, on the other side, argue that these agency fee requirements are constitutional, relying principally on a 1977 decision called Abood versus Detroit Board of Education. And so really, to a large degree, this case is about, should the Supreme Court overrule Abood and declare agency fees unconstitutional, or stay with its current regime of Abood and agency fees? And so I think probably, just so everyone's sort of on the same page, it's probably most fruitful to sort of go through the chronological history of exactly how we got here in terms of the law and in terms of the case development. Now, private sector labor laws, of course, have been around since the New Deal. And their basic framework is that there's an exclusive representative, a union, that represents all employees in a bargaining unit for purposes of dealing with their employer. And also common, at least under the National Labor Relations Act, were so-called agency fee or union shop requirements, under which all employees represented by a union were required, as a condition of their employment, to pay dues or fees to that union. In around 1951, those compulsory fee provisions were also added to the Railway Labor Act. Well, in the 1960s, these type of labor laws started to expand into the public sector, and the general framework was roughly the same. States started certifying unions to be exclusive representatives of their employees for purposes of dealing with their government employers, and in most cases also forcing those employees to pay the unions to act as their representatives for bargaining and otherwise dealing with their employers. Now, conditioning public employment on supporting an advocacy group like a union obviously raised some important First Amendment issues, namely issues of compelled association and compelled speech. And this issue really first reached the Supreme Court in the case I referenced earlier, Abood versus Detroit Board of Education. And there, a number of teachers in Detroit argue it was unconstitutional to force them to support a union to keep their jobs. And what the Supreme Court ruled was it was unconstitutional, but only in part. And the court really created a dichotomy. On one hand, the court said, yes, it's unconstitutional to force employees under the First Amendment to pay for union political and ideological expenses. However, the court held it was constitutional to force these employees to pay the union's costs of collective bargaining and things related to collective bargaining, like contract administration. So employees could be forced to pay a so-called agency fee for collective bargaining, but not a fee for union political expenses. The dissent in that case, however, argued that this distinction doesn't actually exist, that collectively bargaining with the government is political, and that's indistinguishable from lobbying, and therefore this line Abood drew, you know, shouldn't really exist. However, that's the line the court drew, and has more or less been with us since 1977. Now, since 77, there has been a lot of litigation on exactly how to implement a boot. A lot of cases about exactly which union fees are chargeable related to collective bargaining, which are political, what are the procedures unions have to go through to take fees from unwilling employees. But the ABOOT framework more or less stayed the same until about 2012. And in about 2012, a case called Knox versus SEIU reached the Supreme Court. And the issue in that case was, in short, a union basically took a special assessment from non-members to pay for a union ballot initiative campaign. Actually, the union was opposing ballot initiatives by then California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger, which in large part would have protected non-member employees from having union dues taken from them. So the union charges non-members a special assessment to defeat that ballot initiative and said, well, we'll refund you the money we charge you for this the next year after the ballot initiative was over. So this case reached the Supreme Court, and the court ultimately held that assessment scheme was unconstitutional. But really more importantly for this purposes of this call, the court for the first time really started to question ABOOT's framework. The court called ABOOT, quote, an anomaly, which is relatively strong language for the Supreme Court, and also questioned some of its analysis of cases that came prior to ABOOT. So that was in 2012. About a year later, the court took another case called Harris versus Quinn. Now, the issue in Harris was whether or not it was constitutional to compel individuals who are not public employees to pay compulsory union fees as a condition of receiving government money. The individuals in Harris were these Medicaid providers who provide home-based services to Medicaid recipients, oftentimes their own children, and the state would pay them to provide the service. They weren't actually employees of the state, but many states, like Illinois, declared them to be employees solely for purposes of unionization and for paying union dues. So the constitutionality of that was challenged and reached the Supreme Court in Harris. And the petitioners in Harris made two arguments. One is the court should overrule ABOOT, and no one should be forced to pay compulsory union fees, at least in the public sector. The second argument was if they don't overrule ABOOT, at least don't allow it to be extended to individuals who are not full-fledged public employees. And what the court ultimately ruled in Harris was, well, two things. First, the court criticized ABOOT at great length. It actually gave about six reasons why ABOOT was probably wrongly decided. I believe the exact words were its analysis was questionable. And, you know, to summarize them, they really come down to the idea that there isn't a difference between political expenses and bargaining with the government, at least in the public sector, because in either case, you're talking about speech directed at the government. However, the court didn't overrule ABOOT, saying that it didn't need to decide the case, and instead said, well, ABOOT, despite its infirmities, is limited to employees and cannot be extended to these non-employee Medicaid providers. So shortly after Harris was decided, there was another case in the pipeline called Friedrichs versus California Teachers Association. Friedrichs was a direct challenge to ABOOT and to agency fee shop laws in the public sector. And it was brought by a teacher, Rebecca Friedrichs, out of the state of California. So unlike in Harris, the issue was very squarely before the court. The case was argued, fully briefed, and then 1 month after argument, Justice Scalia passed away. So what happened as a result of his passing is the court was down to 8 members, and it split 4-4. 4 members would have voted to overturn the Ninth Circuit, which had upheld ABOOT, and 4 would have voted to affirm the Ninth Circuit's decision saying ABOOT is still good law. So the court broke down that way, unable to make a decision. Well, since the decision in Friedrichs, there's been a presidential election, and Justice Gorsuch was, of course, nominated and confirmed to be the 9th Supreme Court Justice. And so sort of the next case in the pipeline, so to speak, is Janus versus Ask Me. Now, Janus began actually as a lawsuit by Illinois Governor Bruce Rauner, who challenged the agency fee statute in his state, saying that as governor, he shouldn't be able be required to enforce it because he thinks it's unconstitutional under Harris and other cases. A number of employees then intervened into the case, or actually were allowed to file their complaint in intervention. Governor Rauner was dismissed, and the employees became the sole plaintiffs in the case, the lead employee being Mark Janus, who's a child support specialist with the state of Illinois. And his challenge is much like Friedrichs. It's unconstitutional to require that he and other public employees pay these agency fees as a condition of their employment. The case, of course, has now reached the Supreme Court and is scheduled for oral argument on Monday, February 26th. So this will really be the third time this case has been directly before the court, the first in Harris, the second in Friedrichs, and now we'll see if the third time's the charm. And so that's sort of the background of exactly how we got here. As you can imagine, there's a lot of legal arguments on both sides. What I think we'd like to do is turn that over to Ilya, and he'll discuss sort of the arguments both ways.
Great. Well, thanks, Bill. This is Ilya, and I'll apologize ahead of time to the listening audience if I'm not making sense. I have an excuse, and that's the lack of sleep due to the new arrival that Dean mentioned earlier in the program. And not only do we have a newborn, but we also have a two-year-old, so it's a lot of fun in the Shapiro household right now. So the arguments are pretty straightforward, and unlike in the Friedrichs case, there's not sort of an option B or an exit ramp short of voting up or down on keeping a boot or overturning a boot. In Friedrichs, there was a second question about whether these agency fees can be charged on an opt-out mechanism as they currently are, or can they be made, do they have to be opt-in for the workers? And that's obviously important because of inertia and extra burden and having to file something to get your money back or not being charged and all that. Here, that's not an issue. It simply can a state have this law that allows the union to charge fees for non-members? And by the way, there's typically very little difference between the so-called agency fees that are charged to non-members and the full load member dues. I think there's only a difference typically of about 10 or 15%, sometimes less, and it's up to the union and its accountants how it wants to allocate for accounting purposes the funds, the monies that it gets, that is, for the chargeable collective bargaining and other administrative purposes versus the non-chargeable to non-members political or electioneering purposes. Indeed, even to get this accounting, you have to pursue your rights under what's called the Hudson Rule. And the accountants can get quite creative because, for example, the unions can engage in lots of different kinds of member education or publications, which may well be advocating various political positions in addition to whatever truly educational things they might be. But anyhow, the arguments really boil down to two things. So first of all, what has been stylized as the free rider versus forced rider issue. That is, the reason why we allow, the argument goes, the non-members to still be charged fees is because otherwise they'd be getting the benefit of the union's bargain and all the work that union officials put in either to collectively bargain or to help with grievance procedures or what have you without having to pay for it. And so essentially, if you didn't have to pay for it, well, then nobody would join the union, and the union would go out of business because everybody would be free riding on less and less funds. The response to that by Mark Janus or Rebecca Friedrichs in the previous case or others who are similarly situated is that, look, you can keep your bargain. I don't want its benefits. I'd rather opt out of those benefits. You know, for example, in the education context, maybe I would prefer merit pay to tenure protections or vice versa. In the government contracting area, maybe I would like a more flexible work schedule rather than more pay, or vice versa. So all of these different things, whatever the union drives, whatever bargain the union drives, or however it administers its services, these non-members, maybe they just say, well, thanks, but no thanks. And it's, you know, in good faith. It's not that I want a free ride. I really just don't like what you're doing. You're, you know, not representing my interest in that way, and why should I be forced to pay for it? Why should I be forced to associate with it? That kind of opens up the larger rationale for why the court started discussing this free rider issue in Abood and elsewhere, and that's the labor peace rationale. That is the reason why the federal government and states passed legislation that courts upheld, making unions exclusive representatives and then charging these fees against non-members and having whatever mechanisms there are relating to members and things like that, is to prevent problems at the union site. Originally, the labor peace rationale came about in the post-World War II era or even earlier, and there was little violence on the shop floor, either between rival unions or between unions and management. And so to avoid that, you name one union the exclusive representative, give it essentially a monopoly or an oligopoly, and then in turn those who don't want to join to take care of the free rider problem that this labor peace compromise engenders, we allow you to charge. So that's the way that argument goes. I'll get to in a second why labor peace, I think, is not a strong rationale. But the second more broad attack here or challenge is that, you know, whether I like or not, whether any particular worker likes or not, what the union may be doing in terms of what kind of bargain it's driving and when it bargains with the state, with the employer, everything that the union does in the public sector is inherently political. That is, when the Supreme Court in repeated decisions bifurcated what you can and can't charge non-members, it really, in the public sector context, made a distinction without a difference for two reasons. One, because anything that the union does, even on the pure bargaining side, you know, not funny accounting or anything, but pure connective bargaining, trying to make the next contract for the state workers, is inherently has salience in the public policy process, whether that be on education budgets or the general treasury or the regulation of public contracts, size of classrooms, whatever the area is where there are public workers, whatever bargain is struck, that affects public policy. It just flew out of my mind. There you go. I'll use my newborn as an excuse for that. Maybe this will come up. But there is a second rationale as well for why everything is political in the public sector. But anyway, so those are the two things: the free rider, forced rider, buttressed by the labor peace rationale going back decades, and the everything is political, and therefore you can't draw this distinction, and therefore in the public sector, non-members should not be forced. Oh, right, I just remembered the second thing. The second thing is, of course, that money is fungible. That is, even if you're only charging for so-called non-electioneering or non-political spending, that just frees up more money to indeed spend on that non-chargeable activity. So those are kind of like where the battle is drawn on those particular issues. And what is interesting to me is that this is all done not on a tabula rasa, but on not on a blank slate, but with this 40-year-old precedent, Bood having decided 41 years ago, and so it raises the issue of stare decisis, which is conveniently the whole focus of Cato's brief that I submitted supporting Janus and supporting the challengers. And of course, we know that stare decisis is a prudential doctrine. It's not an absolute rule. Otherwise, the Supreme Court would never overturn its own precedent. And so there are a host of practical considerations that the court employs, or lower courts when looking at their own precedent, of course, including how workable has the rule, has it been? How long has it been around? How well entrenched is it? That is, are there reliance interests that are so significant that the overall social cost of getting the law right would impose more costs on society than leaving the erroneous ruling in place? And I think especially in the First Amendment context, and certainly in the constitutional as opposed to statutory context, those considerations are rather low, or rather the stare decisis salience is rather low, first of all, because unlike in statutory cases, Congress can't, if it doesn't like the result the court reaches, just overturn it by passing a new law. In any constitutional case, there has to be a constitutional amendment or some future court reversing its own mind. But here, when we're talking about rights that are at play, nobody relies on having less freedom or less rights. And so certainly there are significant interest on the union side in maintaining the flow of funds to its coffers, to its bank accounts. That sort of very practical reason is not a legal reliance interest. And You know, we can see that simply by the fact that, the 28 states that don't allow these agency fees to be charged, public sector unions do exist there. They have to work harder, of course, to maintain membership and keep the dues flowing. And they've had to innovate in terms of what kind of services they provide. They've had to cut the fat in terms of their own officers and things like that. No indication that workers are being harmed in some way. But anyway, it's you know, different states do it different ways, which leads to an argument about federalism. But of course, individual rights, if indeed they're constitutionally protected, impose a floor below which states cannot experiment. So if you're more interested in kind of the nuts and bolts and the nitty-gritty of the stare decisis analysis, at least the way I see it, the supporting the Janus side, Cato's brief is on that, and when Friedrichs was going around, I've commented in similar ways. Probably the most interesting and most notable amicus brief supporting the unions and the 22 states, Illinois and its supporters that have these rules, were filed by Eugene Volokh of UCLA Law School and Will Bode of the University of Chicago Law School, who are libertarians, very strong supporters of the First Amendment. This, I think, taking this position probably goes against their policy preferences. But what they argue is that there is no constitutional right, First Amendment or otherwise, not to have your money used to convey messages that you disagree with. And so, for example, people are charged taxes all the time to have public service announcements of various kinds and public education programs that either they simply don't agree with the viewpoint or they think it's silly and a waste of money. And, you know, for example, I don't know, to have cops come into your middle schooler's classroom and talk about how bad drugs are or something. Maybe that's a waste of money. They think, sure, we don't want them using drugs, but I'd rather it done a different way, and yet your taxes support that. The response to this, of course, is that there's a difference between the government taxing you and using that money itself versus kind of delegating certain taxation-like authority to a union, and especially in the scenario where public sector unions, it's similar across the country. In Illinois, where this case originates, donated 97% of their political spending to Democratic Party causes. So, in effect, if the government is allowed to do this for the unions, would then it be a fortiori an even stronger case that the government could tax you and then support Democratic Party candidates, rather than using this somewhat inefficient interlocutor, the union, to do so for you? And then, you know, does the question turn on kind of an as-applied, what is the union doing on the ground? A lot of folks have picked up on this kind of you have no First Amendment right type of theory. It's being billed as the originalist theory to support the unions. Don Verrilli, the former Solicitor General, he was speaking at a forum that Cato had that you can look up online on Thursday, I guess about 12 hours before my wife went into labor. He talked about the originalism point and the federalism point, and clearly addressing his remarks to, you know, the best way that would be most friendly to the Cato audience and those who are going to be watching our event online. But anyway, that one has gotten a lot of attention. Bill, I don't know if there's any other amicus briefs that you want to note, any side arguments that are being presented, or Brandeis brief, kind of like economists, or any other kind of non-legal information that I didn't mention.
There's certainly a large number of them. There's about 40 filed, you know, in favor of the unions, and over 20 filed in favor of Mr. Janus. So there's definitely no lack of arguments out there. But one to sort of touch on that, it might, for those who are actually going to listen on Monday or to the recording sometime thereafter, is a very big issue in this case is going to be the standard of scrutiny. Because one reason that Abood was heavily criticized is that it didn't apply either what's called strict or exacting First Amendment scrutiny to these agency fees to support collective bargaining. Now, Abood did apply exacting scrutiny to a fee used to support union political activities, but not the same scrutiny to other kinds of union fees or union activities. However, in Harris and Knox, the court indicator actually held that kind of scrutiny is applicable to agency fees. And so a large amount of the fight in the brief on both sides and a lot of the amici briefs is exactly which standard of scrutiny controls here, because if agency fees are in fact subject to strict or exacting scrutiny, as Harris suggests, then Abood likely is inconsistent with those cases and should be overruled, and agency fees are unconstitutional. So respondents have spent a lot of time arguing that no, agency fees should be subject to a lower standard of scrutiny, usually called the Pickering test, that deals with government restrictions on employee speech, and that agency fees should be measured under the same type of test, and under that they believe they have a better chance of success. Although Abood itself didn't actually use Pickering, so really this is a new argument for it, but that's to a large degree what they've cast their lot in arguing.
If I can jump in, this is Ilya. That's an important point in the stare decisis discussion. To the extent that you want to argue some other justification, that labor peace is outmoded. I didn't get to that, I guess, in discussing my brief, but basically the argument for labor peace was used by the court in its day to justify federal regulation in the first place. It was a commerce clause, and otherwise, where does the federal government get the power to do this? It wasn't a First Amendment justification we can violate the workers' rights, or it's a balancing test or something like that in the interest of labor peace. And so to the extent you swap that out for Pickering or anything else, you're essentially abandoning whatever reliance interest you might have. And there's echoes of Citizens United here, because as Chief Justice Roberts, and look to him at argument, because his concurrence in Citizens United was all about stare decisis, he was cornering then Solicitor General Elena Kagan, now his colleague, of course, on the court, because she had switched the rationale in her argument, the re-argument of Citizens United, from the original one that was used to uphold Austin versus Michigan Chamber of Commerce to a different one now, and that lessened the stare decisis effect.
Well, gentlemen, this is Dino. Are we ready to open it up for questions?
I think so.
Yeah.
Okay. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question for either or both of our guests, push the star button and then the pound button on your phone. Once again, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Looks like we got three questions on the board to begin with, but let me ask a first question if I could, and that is, how do you see this case coming out? The conventional wisdom seems to be 5-4, and I guess I'm addressing my question to Ilya Shapiro, seems to be 5-4 for Janus, and that's part one of the question. Part two of the question, this court seems to bend over backwards to try and get closer and closer to 9-0, even if that just means 6-3. You said this is sort of a yes or no proposition, this case. Is there something that the five might try to do to get a sixth?
Yeah, I think this is Friedrich's redux, and it seemed like, you know, Friedrich's ended up 4-4 and looked for moral argument, like Scalia was going to be with the conservatives striking down the agency fees and overturning Abood. That the joke is that Alito has already written the opinion, because he is the author of Harris and Knox, these preceding cases, and so all he needs to do now is do a control F and replace Friedrich's with Janus, and California with Illinois, and away we go. There was actually some doubt going into argument about where Scalia would be. He was considered to be the swing vote in all of this, given past statements about freedom of contract, and if you've negotiated an uncoerced deal, then that should be okay, and if you don't like it, go work elsewhere. As it turned out in argument, I mean, he was there was no indication that he was anywhere but on the side of the challengers. The conventional wisdom going into argument now is that Gorsuch is more of a sure thing than Scalia was going into argument. So, you know, I guess people will be looking to see if Gorsuch equivocates in any way at argument, but otherwise, it would be shocking if the challengers did not win here, because certainly I'm sure that on the other side there's some hope that either Chief Justice Roberts or someone else kind of reconsiders trying to put some political pressure, that this would change politics, or we're now in a new world with President Trump having been elected, or what have you. I can't see that happening in this short time. And certainly as far as Justice Kennedy is concerned, he is the biggest supporter of the First Amendment and of the freedom of speech on the court. So I wouldn't think that he'd be the swing vote regardless in this particular case. So the smart money is indeed on 5-4, striking down the agency fees, overturning Abood. And I don't see a way for them to reach a 9-0. There's not really a backup position. I mean, I support, I don't know how John Roberts, if he's in a mood to rewrite the law as he has on various occasions, what he could do to this Illinois and similar laws in other states. It really is a yay or nay question. Can you charge non-members or not? And so, again, it was, perhaps, maybe not just as shocking, but equally very surprising would be if Janice won, but on some compromised narrow position.
And just to follow up on that, I'm not going to speculate on exactly how the justices may or may not come out, but just in terms of an argument the respondents are making here, just so it's known that this argument's out there, they're arguing that if Abood is overruled, what the court should do is send the case back down to the lower courts to draw a new line. Or the court should draw a new line and send it back to the lower courts to decide exactly which union expenses are chargeable and not chargeable. The petitioner, Mr. Janice, however, argues that all agency fees across the board should be unconstitutional. So as far as, that could potentially be an issue at oral argument of whether, to declare all agency fees unconstitutional if Abood is overruled or to somehow start drawing new lines.
Once again, if you're in the audience, if you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Let's turn now to our first member of the audience. Go ahead, caller.
Hi, Ilya. This is Lenore. I have a question for you. One of the comments that Eugene Volokh made concerned government, what he called government speech. My limited contact with the doctrine of government speech is that it is, shall we say, undisciplined. It seems to be formless. Sometimes it applies, sometimes it doesn't. Has anyone written about this in any of the briefs to your knowledge?
Well, like I said, I haven't gone through all of the amicus briefs here. But the government speech argument is an odd one. And that's not the claim, I don't think, directly that Eugene makes, at least not in his brief. I don't know if you saw him commenting somewhere else. But his is more nuanced, that there's no First Amendment right not to subsidize speech that one disagrees with. I don't know if he would exactly equate what the unions are saying with what the government is saying. Well, come to think of it now, Ben Sachs, who's a Harvard law professor, does argue that essentially all the money belongs to the unions unless the union decides to carve out some of that, or the court says that some of that isn't properly the unions. It's kind of a, in the state of nature, I guess, everything belongs to the sovereign, and except where he or it wants to disperse that in some way. It's kind of an odd argument, but which I don't think is going to go very far. But it would be an odd, I mean, it's for government speech to really be presented here, it would be the government charging you taxes and then funding, like one of the parties or something like that, or just taking issues in matters of public policy that are, which it does anyway, I suppose. The government can speak in lots of different ways about lots of different areas. Campaigning for support Obamacare or to get out of the Paris Climate Accords or what have you. There's lots of messages emanating from the White House or agencies about government policy positions. But once you, this is a very circumlocuted way of having the government speak. I mean, it's not even the government having a license plate carry a message that you disagree with, which, of course, the Woolley versus Maynard case says that the government can't do. So I don't know. I don't think that it's quite going to be union speech equals government speech. I don't think that's going to be the winning theory.
Thank you.
Two questions pending. If you'd like to join the queue, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. Let's take another question.
Hi. Can you guys hear me now?
We can hear you fine. Go ahead, sir.
Okay. Yeah. Gary Wheaton in New Hampshire again. two-part, if it's okay. First
sure.
part is the accounting of these unions, is it public? I mean, is there any way to see where the money is actually spent? Because I know you mentioned 7% in Illinois. My guess is at least that nationally. That's the first part. And my second part deals with your everything political comment. And there's an area that I don't know if it's a legal area or not. It's a corruption area, right? For example, private sector unions, both sides of the bargaining table have, you know, opposite interests, and they're giving it an honest rate. And the public sector unions, they're allowed to give money to political candidates, political campaigns, if I'm not mistaken. So essentially, the union is on one side of the bargaining table and is also giving money to the other side. So by that very nature, that's a corrupt bargain. So, you know, we can talk about the money being spent by the unions as being political speech. It's also corrupt speech. So I don't think there's a legal argument there, but I just want you guys to think about that one. But the first part of that question is the accounting public? Can we really tell what percentage not only goes to political speech, but also what percentage when you break it down to membership dues and political action? Like they split it, you know, what, 80-20 or whatever that is. My guess is that's not accurate as well. So that's my comment question.
Sure. This is Bill Messenger. So generally speaking, that information is not out there unless the unions want to put it out there. So first, a private sector union actually has to file certain reports with the federal government called LM2 reports, which break down their expenses. But they're not broken down on the same lines as a BOOD between what are called chargeable and non-chargeable expenses. The categories are different. But there are some categories that can be parsed out of there, like collective bargaining, politics, things like that. But that's only of a private sector union. Public sector unions are under no such reporting requirements unless a particular state requires it. In terms of the notices they're required to provide to non-members to which they charge agency fees, which the law requires as a condition of taking that money from a non-member, there's no requirement that those actually be made publicly available by a union. There's no clearinghouse or anything like that that keeps that information. Now, some unions put it on their website. You can find it. Other unions, you know, good luck trying to hunt it down. But there's no, you know, general repository out there, as far as I know, with that information.
Are unions, Bill, do you know, are unions audited by public accounting firms?
So the Hudson notice that they have to provide, named after a case called Chicago Teachers versus Hudson, requires that they produce this financial notice and that also that it be audited in terms of, you know, to look at its numerical sufficiency and such. So that calculation they produce is audited.
Very good. Thanks. Anything on these points, Ilya Shapiro?
Nope, not covering it.
Okay. We've got one question pending, then our lines are open. If you'd like to join the queue, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Let's now take another call from the audience.
Kevin from Albany, New York. The majority of union monies are spent on field reps and attorneys involving either in grievances filed or where charges have been brought against an employee for discipline. And the unions all operate under a duty of fair representation where they have to represent everybody in the bargaining unit and do so on an equal basis, whether they're a member or not. How does that play into this case? And, because if a boot is overturned, they're still going to have that requirement that they expend resources to represent these folks, defend these folks, doesn't that present a problem with undoing a boot? Hello,
Bill, you want to take that?
Sure.
Labor technical.
Sorry, I didn't know it was two fielders both watching the ball come down between them. And so, this is certainly an issue that's come up a lot in the briefs. is this so-called free rider argument. So the respondents, the unions, make very much the argument you say. We're required to represent these individuals, therefore it's only fair that they pay us. But there's several counterarguments that Mr. Janis makes to that. The first of which is that the authority to represent non-members isn't a burden imposed on unions, but rather is a power that unions voluntarily assume. Unions want to be able to represent everyone whether they like it or not, and the non-members have no choice as to whether the union represents them. So to force them to pay for a service they may not necessarily want isn't exactly equitable or constitutional. And then the second is that the union's duty to the non-member is merely not to discriminate against them. A union doesn't have an obligation to really go out of its way to do anything for the union, doesn't even have to, or to the non-member, doesn't even have to really listen to their views. The union simply has to not discriminate against them when acting pursuant to its authority as their mandatory representative. And the argument is that, you know, the union doesn't deserve compensation for not discriminating against the non-member with respect to a type of speech and advocacy that that non-member is forced to accept in the first place. But that argument you bring up, you know, will probably be, certainly was very important in the briefs, and will probably be somewhat central to the argument on Monday.
Is anybody, well, let me make another call for questions. Our lines are wide open right now, no questions pending. If you'd like to ask a question, push the star button and then the pound button on the telephone. Is anybody making an argument sort of on a more granular level that a dues-paying member, I guess this is still the free rider argument, but a dues-paying member, I think the poll I saw or survey I saw said that 35% of only 35% of the members would continue to pay dues if they didn't have to, something like that. But if that's true, and if the cost of bargaining doesn't really go down, are the 35% going to have to pay more dues, and are they still being forced to pay for something that benefits other folks?
Well, this is Bill. So there's a few aspects of that. The first of which, of course, is whether or not union advocacy actually benefits the individual. So a lot of the individuals who don't want to pay, the reason they do is because they oppose the union. They don't support its advocacy. Either they actively oppose it or they just don't think it's worth their financial support. And it's advocacy and representation that the non-member doesn't have any choice about. So really what you have here is a situation where the non-member is being compelled to accept the union's representation whether they like it or not. And the most basic argument is it's unfair to require that individual to pay for something they had no choice in whether or not whether to accept. So from the union member point of view, you know, if union advocacy is what they desire, of course they're more than happy to pay for it, but there's no unfairness to them for the union imposing its representation on individuals who, you know, don't want it in the first place.
And again, if you're in the audience, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone if you'd like to ask a question. I've got just a couple more questions while we see if others weigh in here. Just as, I think, a quick factual question, were all of these arguments made 41 years ago in the Abood case, especially the argument that bargaining in a public sector union is per se a political activity, a political expense, and what's changed in the interim, other than the membership of the court, if the court goes in a different direction?
Bill, have you talked to your colleague Gray Lejeunesse, who was involved in the Abood litigation itself? He also spoke on Thursday at Cato.
Yes, and I think, you know, what you've seen is that a lot of things that were identified to some degree in Abood have become more true over time. Abood itself predicted there's going to be some workability problems with the line that it drew, and the last 40 years have proven that to be repeatedly true. The court itself said that there's been workability problems with trying to figure out exactly how to draw this line and with protecting individual rights under the Abood regime. Abood's inconsistency with other precedents has grown over time. As noted earlier, Abood failed to apply the strict or exacting scrutiny to a compulsory fee for bargaining with the government. Now, you know, that's inconsistent with a score more cases, including cases directly dealing with union fees, such as Harris and Knox. So really the question is, you know, does Abood survive, or do Harris and Knox's scrutiny opinions survive on that? And then finally, the fact that, you know, collective bargaining with the government is a political action has become more apparent over time. Abood was decided in 1977. You know, most public sector unions really just came on the scene in the 1960s. To the extent there's been any question about the kind of political impact collective bargaining can have in the public sector, you know, we've certainly seen that over the last 30 years. It's had a huge impact on a number of states that wasn't necessarily true back in the 60s. So all sort of the infirmities that were identified in Abood in the 1970s have really just become more true and more evident as time has gone on.
Yeah, that's an important, this is Ilya, that's an important part of this, you know, why this has come to the forefront just in the last few years. It was only, I think, 4 or 5 Labor Days ago, this gets, these sorts of things get publicized on Labor Day, union membership, that the number of people in public sector unions became more in this country than the number of people in private sector unions. And so union strength, such as it is, political and otherwise, the center of gravity has rapidly and increasingly shifted to the public sector, and so, which was not the case 40 years ago. You know, public sector unions were still, relatively small. I mean, it kind of, grew a great bit during the Great Society, not during the New Deal, because FDR was against unions in the public sector. But anyway, 40 years ago was a different environment in terms of facts on the ground with public versus private.
Very good. Let me make a final call for questions. Push the star button and the pound button on your telephone if you've got a question. I'll ask a final question of Ilya Shapiro that was sort of alluded to by Bill Messenger already, and that's a union side argument that if worst case scenario from their perspective, this should go back down to the lower court, and the lower court should draw a line. On expenses here, what's political and what's not. Do you want to spend a few minutes talking about that, Ilya?
Yeah, if it's possible to draw that line better, and the court would simply reinforce Abood in some way, I guess, and say, no, but lower courts have to police these things better. The thing is, that issue isn't really presented here. Janice isn't saying that my union is improperly allocating what's being charged for politics versus not. I suppose that could be some future case, but I don't know even if even a district court is going to have the appetite or the capability of doing that accounting, greenlining essentially, because it's in the public sector, it can be such an artificial distinction. I suppose the court can do anything because it's final, not because it's infallible. It's hard to see that kind of piecemeal decision. I mean, I suppose more likely than that would be, okay, Abood stays, but you can't charge any agency fees. Roberts has tried very hard to effectively overturn cases or limit them to their own facts without saying the words overturn, if he can turn a mandate into a tax, he can certainly turn Abood is okay, but agency fees are not kind of opinion.
And that sort of runs into your nearly forgotten fungibility argument too, I suppose.
Right.
It looks like we do have 2 more questions now from our audience. Maybe we can get through these if you gentlemen don't mind returning to the audience. Go right ahead, caller.
Yeah, hi. This is Glenn Bushell in Baltimore. I confess I may be very rusty on this, and I missed the beginning. You may have discussed it. I seem to recall that during the George Bush, the first administration, there was this Beck decision. I don't think it involved public unions, but I thought that it basically gave some support to the union member that didn't want to pay dues. And my recollection, which may be wrong, was that then the Clinton administration didn't want to enforce it. And I haven't heard anything about this in the intervening decades. And I wonder if anything that I've said has any bearing on what you're discussing.
Oh, yes, and your recollection actually is correct. The Beck decision was 1988, and that dealt with private sector employees, namely those under the National Labor Relations Act. And what the Supreme Court did is it basically construed the compulsory fee provision of the National Labor Relations Act to not allow for charging for things not related to collective bargaining, like politics, but only things related to collective bargaining. Basically the same line as drawn in Abood, but did it as a matter of statutory construction to avoid the constitutional problem. After that point, because the National Labor Relations Board has a great deal of control over the National Labor Relations Act and how it's administered, the Clinton administration came along and did, you know, basically everything it could to try to hamstring that right. And to this day, there's still a wide number of cases going on through the National Labor Relations Board, or a wide number of issues, I should say, in a couple of cases, dealing with exactly how to enforce private sector workers' rights, you know, under communication workers versus Beck, to not at least pay for the political expense.
It's consistent then with Janus's position, even if the premises are somewhat different.
So Mr. Janus argues in his brief that if he's successful, you'll actually have a consistent rule across the board, is that no employee could be forced to pay union fees for dealing with the government. Now, of course, for a public sector employee, that's all union fees. But for a private sector employee, it's just, you know, the political and lobbying and things to that effect. So it actually would make a consistent rule across the board for both private and public.
Boy, that would be refreshing. Thanks very much.
It appears that we've lost our final question, so I think we've now had our final question. But we've got a few minutes left. Let me turn to each of you and give you a chance to wrap up or express a final thought. Let's go in the order we began. Bill Messenger, final thought.
The only final thought is, you know, we'll know a lot more come Monday. The argument's at 10 a.m., February 26th. And so, you know, the Supreme Court posts its oral arguments usually by that afternoon, at least the audio. So for anyone interested, tune in and draw your own conclusions.
William Shapiro, a final thought?
Yeah, I'll be very curious to see what kind of differences there are or aren't in the oral argument from the Friedrichs argument. The unions in the states have tried to massage their briefs a little bit to be more philosophical and use natural rights theory when they can in an attempt to persuade or find resonance with Neil Gorsuch, who is, of course, the only PhD on the court and a political philosopher considered to be, you know, the only question, because that 4-4, I guess the conventional wisdom is that it's more likely that Gorsuch would side against Janus than, because we simply don't know, than that any of the four that previously were for Friedrichs would change their mind now. Although a long shot either way, I think. But we will know Monday, presumably, how this all goes down.
Well, I want to thank both our guests today and let our audience know that on Monday, when this case is being argued, Monday afternoon, we have a telephone conference call scheduled with the aforementioned Ray LaJeunesse, Bill Messenger's colleague, at 3 p.m. Eastern Time on the 26th. He'll be attending oral argument and letting us know how he thinks things have transpired there that morning at the court. So thanks to both our guests today and to our audience for dialing in and for your questions. Please do check the Federalist Society's website, monitor your emails for our next upcoming telephone conference call. But until that next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.